or Boston. Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As you probably know, this is our last week on the air, and we decided to spend it speaking with some of our favorite guests from the past 7 years. We're devoting much of today's program to parenting. We're hearing once more from the moms and dads who shared their trials and tribulations with us over the years. But first, we are getting some mother wit and wisdom from poet Nikki Giovanni. She's joined us a number of times over the years. Most recently, she spoke with us in May when her good friend, the legendary Maya Angelou, died.
Maya had an embrace of life, and it's rare. You know, even I like being alive, but even I don't come anywhere near this, that joy that she brought.
Today, Nikki Giovanni is with us once again from Roanoke, Virginia. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us on this special week for us.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So tell us how you came into yourself. I mean, you've described yourself as a truth teller, which you are. And I just wonder how you came into that.
I don't know. Let me answer honestly and clearly. I don't know. But I am the baby in the family. And I think babies look at life a little differently because your older brother or your older sister, in my case, an older sister, your older sister is always more talented, always more beautiful, always better able to do things. And so you end up watching all the time, and you watch, and you watch. And some of the things that you watch, you say, oh, that's good. And some of the things you watch, you say, I don't think I would do that. And I think that as a baby, you know, if you look at the number of writers, it is amazing how many of us are babies. Mm-hmm. Or in the family, how many of us are either only children or the youngest child? Because those are the people that have to watch.
Interesting. You know, as you know, this is a moment of transition for us. And in recent years, you've written yourself a lot about transitions that we all have to go through, losses and so forth. What do you think has been the most helpful thing to you in working through transitions?
I think the most helpful, you say in transitions, and I think you mean death. And I think the most helpful thing in going. Okay.
I do. But also there are other losses. There's death, but there's other losses. There's losses of things that you like, you know, places to work or colleagues, things of that sort. Yeah.
I guess so. But to me, if right now Virginia Tech fired me, I would consider that an opportunity. And I would say to myself, okay, Virginia Tech has given me an opportunity to go someplace else and do something. The loss of my mother, my mother's death, was an incredible loss to me. And what I knew I had every right, if not responsibility, to do is to mourn. Now, when your mother dies, and my mother died June 24th, 2005, but my sister died August 10th, 2005. Mm-hmm. So we buried Mommy together, but then I went from being a baby in the family to being an elder because my sister died, within weeks of that. So I had a lot to do. And a lot of it, you know, you have a house you have to sell. You have things in the house. You have, you know, it's the dump. And I am a responsible individual. And I said to myself, Nikki, you have to do it because there wasn't anybody else to do it. My Aunt Ann died in October. Mm. So it was just going to be a very difficult period. And it was. But I did what I was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But when I did get it done, I said to Alex, who is my dog, I said to Alex, you know, now we can sit down on the deck and we can mourn Mommy, or in Alex's case, grandmother. But I got up and did that thing that I think Americans do. I was just laughing about it. I got up and poured myself a glass of wine and took it out on the deck and sat down and drank it until it was time for, you know, to change to a nice red wine. And I'd sit there and do that until it was dark. And then, you know, you go in and you start the same thing. Finally, it was Alex who actually, and I laugh about it because I think that you're just not embarrassed. You're not allowed to embarrass your dog. And finally, Alex looked at me one day, you know, about the 10th day of me doing that, and had one of those again, you know, Nikki, you know, you can't keep doing this. And I said to her, to Alex, you know, I said, you know, grandmother, which my mother, I said, but grandmother drank a beer every day of her life. We knew Mommy was dying because she didn't want a beer. And so I said to Alex, well, why don't we go and get a beer and drink it for Mommy? But I don't like beer. And I never did. I don't know why people drink it. And so we went up to the local bookstore, the Barnes & Noble, actually, and looked up what is the number one beer. I thought, if I'm going to drink a beer, I'm going to drink the number one beer in the world. And the number one beer is Utopia. It's a Sam Adams. And so I started to look for Utopia. It's $350 a pint, so you know you can't get it in your regular, you know, grocery store.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? And so it was just, and I don't know why, but the book became Chasing Utopia. And I ended up writing this book about the loss, the death of my mother, but also about a lot of people that I love. My grandmother. Can I read your poem?
Yeah, please. Would you? I was going to ask.
Speaking of grandmother,
yeah, please.
My grandmother's a good cook, and I'm not a bad cook, but not quite as good as grandmother. It's called The Right Way. My grandmother's grits are so much better than mine. Mine tend to be lumpy and a bit disoriented, though that's probably my fault. I always want to put 1 cup grits into 4 cups cold water with 1 teaspoon salt and start them all together. Grandmother did it the right way. She started with cold water that she brought to a boil, shifted the grits slowly from her hands into the bubbles, then added her salt. She also hummed while she stirred with her wooden spoon. I wonder if I should learn to sing.
Wonderful. If you're just joining us, we are speaking with the award-winning author and poet Nikki Giovanni. She's sharing some pearls of poetic wisdom with us. And we're talking, that was a poem from her collection, Chasing Utopia. We'll talk a little bit more about, I don't know, I'm hearing you. You're saying that there's losses and then there's losses that seem like losses, but they're actually really opportunities.
Well, most things are opportunities. If your car breaks down and you say, oh, gosh, you know, my car is broken down, this is an opportunity to either fix the car because you love it or to get rid of it because you've been tired of it and get a new one. I just think you have to look at almost everything as an opportunity. But losing people is a loss. And Americans need to learn to mourn. We don't allow people to mourn. And I think that mourning is incredibly, incredibly important. I think that it's necessary that you recognize I am sad today, and I will probably be sad for a long time. When it's something like your mother, you'll be sad the rest of your life because you won't live long enough to get what other people will call over it. You don't want to get over the loss of your mother any more than she would want to get over the loss of you.
That's so true. It's funny because people often think that great art comes out of suffering. And I get the feeling that you don't agree with that at all.
I'm not a big
fan. I've never asked you that question. I shouldn't presume. Let me ask you this question. What do you think?
No, it's a good question. I just don't think that suffering is a good idea. So I'm not in favor of suffering. I'm in favor of finding out what is the message. And sometimes the message is simply, you know, you have a right to cry. And some other times you have to really say, as I was sharing about Mommy, I have responsibilities. So despite the fact that I am incredibly sad, somebody has to get these things done. I don't have a right to be selfish about my emotions. I had, by the way, if I may, I was diagnosed 14 years ago with lung cancer. And I knew that this was serious business. Most people that have lung cancer die. So the first thing I had to say to myself was, okay, I need a doctor. I need good doctors. But I also knew that it made me incredibly sad. And if anybody who's listening to us has been diagnosed with cancer, it is just, you don't want to hear it. It's a very sad thing. And I said to myself, okay, I know that if I allow myself to be sad, I'm going to make myself worse. So what I have to do is find time to be sad, and then I have to go about my business of trying to see if I can find a way not to defeat cancer, and I would never, ever, ever use those words, but to live with it. And so what I did was I finally said to myself, okay, between 8 and 9, because my first doctor's appointment was going to be 10 in the morning, something like that, between 8 and 9, I went into my bathroom. I have a door on my bathroom door, closed the door, and I cried. I was incredibly sad. And then I took a shower, and then I went to see the doctor. And if something happened during the day that really made me, I had one doctor that actually said to me, you know, Ms. Giovanni, I don't think you're going to live. And I did have to say to him, am I paying you? You know, I really hope if I'm paying you, send me the bill because I don't ever want to see you again. Because if I die, I'll be the first to know it. So you don't have to tell me that. You know, you have to. That's the truth. I would recognize.
Break it down.
Yeah, Nikki, yeah. I'm dead. Nikki, you're gone. And I just thought it was incredibly cruel of him and crazy to do that. And so I did. I paid him and I walked out of there. But I didn't. I wanted people to say, well, let's see what we can do. And the people that have carried me through this. I am now, as you know, if you do actuarial tables on cancer, I am now back to the point that I have the same chance of dying of lung cancer as if I never had it. And that's the best it's going to be for people like me, but that's the best it is for everybody.
Well, I'm so glad.
Thank you.
So do you have any advice for us as we kind of transition to whatever comes next for those of us?
Oh, approach it with a smile. Because whatever's coming next is going to be good because you've got all of this information, you've got this talent, you've got things that you love. You have to approach it with a smile. And if you keep smiling, something else is going to happen. And you might say, well, Nikki, I'm not sure what it is. I don't know either. I really, really don't. But I know that, isn't that an old song? Good things come to those who wait. Well, that's Duke Ellington. I love you madly. And what we're all trying to do is enjoy life. Life is a good idea, and it's a lot of fun, and there's a reason that the first miracle, if you recall, I'm a Christian, that Jesus' first miracle was, in fact, turning water into wine. He could just as easily have turned wine into water, but no, he had the sense to say these people need something to drink, and I think if it's good enough for Jesus, good enough for me.
All right. But that being said, Nikki Giovanni is an award-winning poet, professor, and author. She was kind enough to join us from Roanoke, Virginia. And yes, we are smiling now. Thank you, Nikki. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Good things come to those who wait. I just relax and wait for fate to let me see the day you say to me, I love you. Love you madly.
Coming up, we've always heard from moms over the years, but the dads quickly let us know they wanted in on the conversation too. They had their own take on the joys, frustrations, and the wisdom that comes with parenthood.
I try really, really hard to tell my kids I love them, to explain to them when they get in trouble, why they get in trouble, and to try to never discipline out of anger.
Our final conversation with our panel of dads, that's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of how one Polish scientist battled typhus and sabotaged the Nazis. He saved thousands of Jews and intellectuals during the Nazi occupation, some by giving them a typhus vaccine, others by employing them in his lab, where they let body lice suck their blood to produce the vaccine. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Since this program began, our parenting roundtable, where we've consulted with a diverse group of parents, has been a signature of this program. Why? Because we think it's been helpful in a world that's more diverse than ever, more complicated than ever, to hear common sense advice from people with different backgrounds and perspectives. So, since this is our last week of production, we wanted to hear from our trusted contributors one last last time in this venue anyway. In a few minutes, we will hear from a group we started with, our panel of moms. But first, we wanted to hear from parents who say they've been left out of the conversation too long, and that is the dads. With us now are four of our go-to dad guests. Lester Spence, he's Associate Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, a father of five. Felix Contreras is co-host of NPR's Alt Latino podcast and a dad of two. Dan Bukatinski is an Emmy-winning actor, best known as James on the hit show Scandal. He's also a TV writer and producer and author of the book, Does This Baby Make Me Look Straight? Confessions of a Gay Dad. He's a father of two. And Phil Lerman is a TV producer and author of Daditude, How a Real Man Became a Real Dad. He's a father of one and a stepdad of one. I'm just so happy to welcome all of you back with us once again.
Thanks for having us.
So let me start off by having a little bit of fun with the dad stereotype. I apologize in advance. Here's a clip from a trailer from the 2003 Eddie Murphy movie, Daddy Daycare.
Now they're prepared to go where no daddy has gone before.
Can't men do anything that women can do?
No, we can't.
Welcome to Daddy Daycare.
Don't panic, because they're like animals. They can smell fear.
D-Day.
We're going to have to up our game today, all right? We need some instruction, some planned activities.
We need Ritalin and leashes. That's what we need.
Okay. All right. I said I'm sorry in advance, but so hopefully I'm covered. But Lester, let me start with you, because you have five. You wear the crown here. When you're honest, did you ever feel that way as a dad?
Can you say hell no on NPR?
I guess so.
Just did.
What are they going to do, cancel us? So.
No. I mean, the challenges I had were challenges of youth. You know, I had my first kid when I was barely 25, but everything, I knew how to cook, I knew how to clean, I knew how to change a diaper, I knew how to braid hair, I knew, and I learned, and I didn't feel nervous about any of these things. When Sean had to leave, you know, when she had to leave for periods of time, I had it. It wasn't like I was pulling my hair and making, you know, making casserole for the kids, you know, one of those
little microwave
pads.
Well, you don't have any hair, but nevertheless. But to that end, I think that this is this kind of yet another image. You know, you're an African American man, you're an intellectual, you're an academic, and so there are lots of issues you have with the way you are presented in the media. But is this kind of one more thing where that dads get a bad rap?
Oh yeah, we do. And then for me, that's not quite as bad as when I had Imani and when I would carry her in the stroller, and all these women would smile at me like, oh my God, he's taking care of his kids. Like, I'm supposed to do that, right?
Felix, what about you? Have you felt you've had to fight your way into the dad conversation, or even to have conversations about being a dad?
Sort of. I mean, I'm complete opposite, I think, here of what he just said, because I had my first when I was 42. So, you know, any of the challenges I had were, you know, I was set in my ways. And, you know, my way or the highway kind of thing I had to get over. I'm still trying to get over that. But I think that when you look at the landscape of all the media coverage and just the conversations, I think that dads do get a short end of the stick in a lot of ways. You know, when people more dads than not step up and take care of things and just do it, because that's, you know, that's just what's supposed to happen.
Yeah, Phil, what about when you... I'm curious about what made you want to write your book. Was it in part, what void did you feel were filling? Or
it's funny you ask that, because it was exactly on this topic that when I came out with that Daditude and I went around talking about it, mothers all came up to me with the same story afterwards. I'm so glad you wrote this because my husband's an idiot. And women love to tell me how their husband's an idiot. He can't change the kid. He can't feed the kid. He can't do anything. And that's the image that you're talking about. And dads are not like that. Dads can do whatever moms can do. You know, with one exception. if you can change a tire on a Camaro, you can change a diaper, right? And the lug nuts are a lot easier to loosen on the diaper. It's something that moms like to do, and it's something I found in the workplace that editors or producers would always say to me, oh, the script they gave me was so bad, good thing I was here to fix it. And it's something that happens in the workplace. You want to show that you're extremely needed in the workplace, so you show, I'm the good one here, the other one's the idiot, thank God I'm here. And moms do that to dads. That's how they can feel in control of the house. I'm the smart one here, dad is the idiot.
Okay, but I could make an argument that, you know, easy for you then, you could just be like, oh, I'm an idiot, it's your deal.
And that's exactly what happens, and that's why moms tend to take control, and a lot of dads dads tend to step
back.
But
why did you feel a need to fight for it? You wanted to fight for your respect as a parent.
I think, like Felix, because I was an older dad and I knew this was the last chance I was going to get, I didn't want to miss out on everything. Mm. So from the time my son was born, I was in there. I changed all the diapers for the first 2 weeks, and I used to kick my wife out of the house for a couple hours just to be there. I didn't want to miss out. And more importantly, for your kid, and we all know this, a kid needs you to be there. As boys need their dads, girls need their dads. They want their dad to be there. There's no reason, if you have two parents in the house, to not have two parents in the house. Yeah. And for Max's sake, more than anything else, I wanted to be there.
Dan, what about, you know, as a gay dad, you didn't have the pressure of mommy knows it all dynamic because you're a household of two dads. I'm curious about, first of all, why you wanted to write your book. And what void you kind of felt was being filled there, besides the fact that it's screaming out loud funny. But but talk a little bit about that whole question of what do you feel like you have to fight for your space as a dad?
Well, I think to some degree, it was never a question that there would not be a mom in the equation. So it was really about two dads sort of figuring out what roles we would play as dads. In many ways, I felt this feeling like we were going to have to encompass everything. Those things that traditionally you might feel society has delegated to the mom would have to be covered by us. Those things that traditionally felt like they were delegated to the dad had to be delegated to us. And it started to make me feel like, wow, we really are all parents. I don't know why the words... I mean, I feel like I have as much of a maternal instinct as I have a paternal instinct. And I guess that part of me that once my daughter was born, I felt this need to, this desire, this sort of impulse that if I had had a boob, I would have put it in her and fed her. And I had I felt the same sort of maternal instinct. And I wanted to write about those things that suddenly made me feel like I was a member of a larger, you know, I wasn't, you'd think that the gay parent or the gay dads or those who might feel ostracized, in a weird way, I actually felt like I had entered into a much larger brotherhood and sisterhood. And I felt this need to sort of unite us and talk about my experience in a way that would make others be like, oh, right, of course, you know, the diaper smells the same. We just may look a little cuter while we're changing them. But so I felt this, you know, I ultimately wound up wanting to write about, and also my panic, my sheer panic, which has not left me. I felt like I wanted to share that and see, you know, to what degree we all feel that. And, you know, it's all about how well you cover it as you teach them.
I want to hear a little bit more about where you can get that. I mean, obviously, this has been a vehicle for that. This program has been a vehicle for that, for, you know, giving people an opportunity to talk about those things who might not have anybody in their own lives that they feel comfortable approaching, or letting them know about your book, or Dan's book. So I want to hear before we go about how you think other, you know, dads can accomplish that for themselves. To that end, though, and if you're just joining us, our panel of dads is here giving us some dad advice one last time in this venue. I'm joined by Dan Bukatinsky, Phil Lerman, Felix Contreras, and Lester Spence. Lester, I just want to play a moment from our archives that I think was one of the more powerful ones that we've had in this space. It was just this past December, and I asked you what your best parenting moment of 2013 was, and this is what you said.
For the past several years, we haven't paid a mortgage, and we've been in threat of foreclosure like once or twice. I mean, significant economic anxiety. And this year, just as the last quarter of the year, we were able to come to a solution with Bank of America. It's not a perfect one, but it was one. So if I think about parenting, my first responsibility is to keep a roof over my kids' head. And they didn't know what was going on, as I'm sure most listeners, and you probably didn't know what was going on. But that's been the best moment for me, for that thing to be settled.
So thank you again for sharing that with us. You are absolutely right. I had no idea. And I appreciate that, because at any time you kind of open the door, you make other people feel less alone. But yeah, what I'd like to know is what now? I mean, where does that come from now? Where are you going to get that now? I mean, do you have a group of fathers that you talk to about these kinds of issues? And if where do you get that?
That's a really good question. My relationship with my father has grown over the years. But my father grew up like a lot of, you know, that generation, that kind of people born
around between 40 and 1940, 1950. They grew up, you know, their way of the highway. And I saw my dad work every day, literally every day on the weekends. He'd get overtime and he would just grind. And some days he would just come home, drink a six pack, go to bed and do it over again. And I didn't understand what was going on there. I had a lot of, I was a lot closer to my mom, but as I grew up, I actually saw what my dad was dealing with and why he chose to deal with it the way he dealt with it. And we would talk, and, particularly, you know, after undergrad, you know, we would talk a lot, and it was really been him. And then to a certain extent, my fraternity brothers, I'm a member of Omega Psi Phi. It's been some of my fraternity brothers, the ones that I came into the fraternity with, that I felt comfortable enough to actually say, this is what I was going through. And then what they did was they gave me, just talking about it out loud helped me to navigate my fear. And then they just emphasized, they just reminded me of who I was, right? Because I think a lot of us, when we're dealing with something like this, we tend to forget that we do have the capacity to go through this. And as fearful as it is, as fearful as that dynamic, I literally, and I was going up for tenure, I did not know whether they would come for the house and me get kicked out of my job at the same time. But I was just like, every day, every day, every day. And that's what helped me get through it. And then all I have to do is just draw back on that memory, right?
Phil, what about you? I've noted that there are all kinds of mommy blogs out there. There are some that include dads, like DC Urban Moms and Dads, for example, in this area. And of course, you know, we've had those folks on this program. But everybody doesn't live in an area like that where there is a DC Urban Moms and Dads. What do you do? What are you going to do? Do you have a circle of dads that you can go to?
I'll tell you something. My son was, Max was diagnosed with an anxiety disorder about a little more than a year ago. And we didn't know at first. He was calling up every day with stomach aches from school. And we did all the things people do. You took him for CAT scans and gastroenterologists and Zantac and all this stuff. And he missed about 20 days of school, and we finally came to realize that this was a psychological problem. And at first, we tried to tough it out with him. You know, he was on a little league team with, this is what it is to be in D.C. His baseball coach was one of Mitt Romney's economic advisors. And it was welcome to D.C. And they were a very tough, you know, kind of tough it out, don't coddle your kid kind of joint. And I made him stay with it and try to get him to tough it out. And it was the worst, stupidest thing I ever did, and it was really tough on him. But through therapy and through a lot of help, we've managed to get him through it, and he made it through school this year. He missed one day of school. And the reason I bring it up is I learned from him. What helped him the most was he had to do a presentation in school and decided to do a presentation about his anxiety disorder. And he talked to the other kids about it, and you wouldn't believe how many kids came up to him and said, me too. Yeah. Yeah. It was like there were tears. It was incredible. And so I started talking to some of those parents and engendering that conversation. Once you find some way to break through your friends, especially for guys, if you can break through, hey, how you doing? How the Mets doing? What's going on? How's work? If you can break through to that conversation with your friends, that conversation, once you start it, it never ends. Mm-hmm. And it's such a valuable conversation. And I learned it from listening to Max teach me that it's important to open up to my friends.
Dan, what about you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think a very male trait is this one that doesn't necessarily want to show our cards or show our feelings or show our weakness. And parenting in general is one where you sort of feel this duty, this pressure to seem like you know what you're doing. And especially when you're gay dads and in general you are met oftentimes in public places in particular with looks like, oh, wow, there's no mom there. How are they going to do it? So you feel this need to, even if you don't know what the hell you're doing in a particular moment, to seem like you do. Well, that to me, you know, is a dangerous feeling because ultimately it is sharing with other parents and listening to other parents and admitting to other parents when you don't know. You know, getting into the school community, especially where I live, was a huge help to me because suddenly you're on the schoolyard every morning with other parents and you don't necessarily have to feel like, oh, this is the place where I need to show that I've got it all worked out. This can be the place where you say, you know, we just figured out, and we did. Our daughter had dyslexia, and it was nothing to be ashamed of, and something that was both going to create strengths in her and weaknesses, like any kid. And what do we do now? And where do we go? And oh, there's a school. And by talking about it, by just opening up and not being afraid to show, like, we didn't know what to do. This amazing community of both men and women, fathers and mothers, opened up to us.
Felix, final thought from you?
I think that ultimately, when we use the established circles we already have, and in my case, my kid's fence. I play music part-time. So I talk to, you know, you spend hours on the fencing strip at these tournaments. You end up striking up conversations with other families. That's where I was like, hey, my 14-year-old, my 13-year-old's doing this and this. Yeah, well, mine does the same thing, and this is what I do. You know, those kind of things. I think that where the dads open up is where, you know, if you're sports inclined, whatever it is, if you're in a chess club, when you're involved in your activity, and then you get past whatever it is you're doing, you develop these friendships, that's when things, I think, open up. That's how it's been for me. When I'm playing music with some of the guys I play with, again, the fencing thing, that's where you exchange information, exchange ideas.
Well, thank you all so much for opening up with us all these years. We really appreciate it. We've appreciated all your insights. I've learned from each and every one of you, and I just am so appreciative. Felix Contreras is co-host of NPR's Alt Latino podcast, Dad of Two, here in Washington, D.C., along with Lester Spence, associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, father of five. Phil Lerman is a TV producer, author of Dadtitude, father of one, and stepdad of one. Dan Bukatinski is a TV writer, producer, and Emmy-winning actor, and author of Does This Baby Make Me Look Straight? And a dad of two, with us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you, as always.
And our diverse panel of moms has been with us from the beginning. They've shared advice on everything from finding the right daycare to launching children into adulthood.
Ultimately, you have got to prepare them to live on this earth without you and without your support and without your money. So think of it that way.
Our regular moms contributors join us one last time. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Please.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
I'm Eric Glass. A cop pulls a guy over because his van is swerving across the road.
Standing next to the man was a chimpanzee. The man said he was doing really well, and then he lost control of the van. And I'm like, lost control of the van? Like, at what point was the chimpanzee really in charge of this thing?
Some stories just don't fit under the daily news shows. This American Life.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Decatur Celebration, August 1st through 3rd in downtown Decatur. Headliners include Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, Joe DiMassina, Ruben Studdard, and many more. Events include a carnival, Razzle Dazzle Good Times Parade, and a hot dog eating contest. Details at DecaturCelebration.com.
Tune in to WILL-TV as our Fund Your Favorite Summer schedule continues. This week features two locally produced documentaries focusing on Central Illinois stories. First, experience Abraham Lincoln's time as a young lawyer in Illinois in Lincoln, Prelude to the Presidency. Then, Ten Sisters, a True Story, tells the dramatic tale of the Wagoner sisters, separated in 1942, only to be reunited decades later. It all starts Friday night at 8 on WILL-TV.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We just heard from our go-to panel of dads. We are going to end today where we began, with our moms. In the past 7 years, actually, even before that, when we started online as the Rough Cuts podcast, anybody remember that? We've gotten their best advice on everything from multicultural Santa Clauses to confronting bullies to how to support a transgender child. We've talked about all kinds of child-rearing philosophies, from helicopter parenting to so-called free-range parenting. And on occasion, they give big ups to old school parenting, if you get my meaning. So how could we end without sampling their greatest hits and squeezing out a few more tips with Jolene Ivey? She's a Maryland state lawmaker and a mom of five and the co-founder of a parenting support group, the Mocha Moms. Leslie Morgan Steiner is with us. She's an author, most recently of The Baby Chase and a mom of three. Araceli Panameño is director of Latino Affairs at the Center for Responsible Lending. She's a mom of one. And recently, she has become the grandmother of one. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And Danny Tucker is an administrator and a fitness instructor and a mom of two. Welcome back to everybody. Thank you all for coming.
Hey,
thanks,
Michelle.
Gracias,
thank you.
Michelle.
So let me start by digging something out of the archives. This was June 2007, just weeks after we went on the air. We talked about the pressure a lot of women feel to be a perfect mother. And Jolene, this is what you said.
Uh-oh. I was a perfect mother, let me tell you. No, there was a time when I actually, not only did I make my baby's food, I made organic cat food.
No.
Okay,
makes me sick.
And it was very scary, but I only had two children then, and my husband said, you don't have enough to do. And I think he was right. Now, I have definitely grown as a mother since then, quite a bit. And I do look at it as growing when I was able to give up things like making the cat's food. For God's sake, give me a break. So now everybody's lucky to get a meal from me at all these days because I am really busy. But I had to really think about what is important. And those things are not important. They're just not.
So what do you think when you hear that?
Well, you know, it's true. I remember making the cat's food, and that was kind of insane. And I just had another super busy year, and I had to hire people to cook for my family because there was no other way that they were going to live other than they'd be eating, you know, got pizza delivery and wings from 7-Eleven. That would have been it. So, and actually it turned out to be quite affordable. So I was happy about that, but I did miss cooking. And it's just one of those ways we take care of our families, and I miss that. And it was kind of interesting hearing that again.
When have you changed your mind? Just thinking about the time that we've been working together, is there anything else you think you've changed your mind about over the last 7 years about what's important and what isn't?
Well, I'm not sure I've changed my mind. It's been kind of interesting for me to get feedback from people because I sit here in a room with you lovely ladies, and you're like just friends I sit and talk with. And then you forget that there's all these other people out in the world who hear your conversation. And they send me emails, you know, to my personal email address or to my Facebook account, and they tell me how wrong I am about things I've said and done. And, you know, I always listen because I'm pretty good about considering people's opinions, and then I pretty much decide, no, I'm still right.
Okay. Leslie, what about you? Is there anything you think you've changed your mind about over the last 7 years, or is there anything that you think maybe these conversations have helped you see differently?
Oh, so much. You know, the first thing is that my life has changed so radically in the last 5 years that I've been coming on this show. My kids are now teenagers. My mom died a couple of years ago. After 20 years of marriage, I'm getting divorced. So it's a really different time for me as a parent and as a woman. But the constant for me has been how much I have loved the conversations we've had. I think that there is a real lack of civilized disagreement among moms today. And what I've treasured about being on this show has been having really different opinions in this studio and having it be very respectful and having my opinions respected, but you know, sometimes disagreeing. And I also love all of the moms who come up to me in car line or, you know, via Facebook or email and tell me that they either agreed or disagreed. I think that's what I long for so much in my life going forward, is to continue this conversation with moms about the great work of motherhood and how we all do it so differently.
Mm-hmm. Araceli, what about you? Is there anything you've changed your mind about over the years that you've been on the air? And congrats on becoming a grandma.
I'm very excited. Thank you. Shout out to Saida Gabrielle.
who is in a NICU at UVA Medical. She was a preemie, but we're looking forward to bringing her home. So I'm very excited about, you know, sitting by her side and reading stories to her in Spanish and in English and praying and supporting my daughter and her boyfriend. Have I changed anything? I think as my colleagues and friends here at the table, I have really totally treasured being with you ladies. This has been a diverse panel, not only race, ethnicity, but also socioeconomically. And it has allowed me to compare notes and to know that in the commonality and the fundamentals of being a mom, that we have this commitment to actually making our children better people. That we're able to, right, than we could ever be ourselves. Try to help them avoid the pitfalls, try to teach them lessons and to love them above all, to love them. And so it has compared notes, learned, and reaffirm what I know as a parent, what I've learned from my grandmother and my mother.
Mm. Danny, what about you?
Same here. I mean, I've matured as a mother. And I thank you all, every last one of you, for helping me do that. I agree with all that was just said about how our lives have changed. And at the same time, having this sisterhood that we have had has helped me see different aspects of motherhood, the way different people do it, and how we still have a common ground and that we all want the same thing for our kids. So I truly have been blessed. And just thank you all for having me. It's just been a wonderful time.
If you're just joining us, it's our final Moms panel. Our regular contributors are with us, Danny Tucker, Araceli Panameño, Leslie Morgan Steiner, and Jolene Ivy. Leslie, now it's your turn. I have another clip from the archives. This is from 2008, and I asked you what advice you would give your own children about parenting, and this is what you said.
Mm-hmm. Parenthood is incredibly hard, and no one can capture the great highs and the great lows. And this idea that motherhood is supposed to balance us is so crazy. Kids are actually supposed to unbalance us and make us feel rage like we never felt before and love like we never felt before and peace and insanity. And I would encourage my kids to go for it with their eyes wide open and try to enjoy it as much as possible.
So is there anything you think you were wrong about?
Oh my God, so much that I was wrong about. Oh boy. But I stand by what I just said on that clip from so many years ago. And, my kids, they used to love me so much. And now that they're teenagers, they just hate me so passionately at times. And I got to say, I still love it. I love the teenagers. And I hated my mom when I was a teenage girl, too. And so I don't take it personally. And I think that parenthood is a great, great adventure. I think what I was wrong about is that there was any kind of control possible here. And I also think that like Jolene, I started out to be the perfect mom with perfect children. And every single minute of motherhood, my standards have gone down. And that is the most wonderful thing. You know, I used to think that my daughter was going to be like the next president of the United States. And really now I just want her to graduate from high school and maybe go to college, any college, doesn't matter. I don't want my kids to go to jail. I want to have them in my life. And motherhood has a way of just breaking us down and humanizing us, I think, if we go with it in that way. And I feel very lucky to have gone with it in that way and to have had everybody here at Tell Me More, you especially, Michelle, to help us find that all together.
Yeah, Danny, what about you? I have to say that I hear about each of you, as you would imagine, through various venues and at the grocery store and in the on Facebook, and of course, each of you has a following, and I'm grateful for that. But Danny, I have to say that of all the guests, I often hear the most about your comments, because you stand up for kind of tough love, old school style, and also also just letting people know that everybody's lives are different, and sometimes the decisions you feel you have to make are different from the ones that people make who have different circumstances. And I just wanted to ask if there's anything that you want to say that you haven't had a chance to say. You know, also, your life has changed a lot, too. I mean, you've opened your own business. You've sent your son off to the Navy. You started, when we started, you had, a little girl at home and a preteen, and now you've got a Navy man.
And off to college next year she goes.
And your daughter off to college next year. Anything that you want to add that you feel like you want to say that you haven't had a chance to say?
Nope, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I'm going to stick to it till they're 40. I'll be going upside their head when they're 50 if necessary. I mean, I am who I am, and I ain't changing, you know. But I have grown with my kids, you know, and they have grown with me, and it has been just wonderful journey, you know, to just grow with your kids. I mean, one thing I would say or add to the things I've added is grow with your kids. If I haven't said that over the 7 years, grow with your kids, because sometimes we feel like we don't need to grow anymore. Oh yes, we do. And my kids have taught me that I'm still growing, I'm still maturing, and I'm still, you know, metamorphosing into this, you know, next stage of parenting. It doesn't stop. You know, I'm parenting young adults now. Whoa, we need to do a show on that now.
You know? We'll figure that out. We got to find a spot. Really, if we have to gather on the corner, we can do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Araceli, what about you? One of the things that you've brought to us is that whole experience of, like, you know, being a parent and having one foot in one world and one foot in another world. And you've talked about, like, having, say, elders from, you know, your home country, like second guessing your choices and saying, you know, this is wrong, or you're letting your daughter go, and having your daughter second guess you to say, Mom, you know, you're too old school. That's old country. That's not the way it is. Is there anything you want to add about that you haven't had a chance to say that you really think is important?
Yeah, no, straddling the cultures has been a significant challenge. And being here with you all, you know, as I said, reaffirms and confirms sort of like female intuition, I would say. Which is very important for us to listen to. I would agree with Danny in terms of my willingness to learn. If that is one of the things that I've learned from my daughter, you know, that I needed throughout her life, it was a process of my letting go of her, teaching her to be an independent self. And so learning to let go, it took 20 years for me to do that. So I have not necessarily changed my mind on anything. Our relationship now that she's a mom, she is come around. She's sort of like telling me the lessons that I, you know, so eagerly tried to teach her. And I did not know if it had stuck. But now she's repeating certain things, and I'm listening, and I hear the echoes of the messages that I was delivering. And I'm really glad that she got it.
You know, one of the things I'm curious about, though, is you know, one of the things that I've appreciated is that a lot of people have told us, well, this, I feel like I'm listening to my mother and my sisters at the kitchen table. But most people don't have mothers and sisters who are, you know, African-American, Latino, you know, white, and like all these different backgrounds. And the question I have is, like, how do you get this without something artificial like this? I mean, you know, we created this and we called each other up and said, okay, why don't you do this? And then Leslie, you wrote a book, and Araceli, we heard about you because when you ran for office in Prince William County, that's how we met. Yeah. And then Jolene, you're a state lawmaker and you had this parenting support group. And Danny, you were in the media before working at it. So how do you get that benefit of different perspectives without something kind of invented? Because one of the things that, you know, kids open up your world, but they also narrow it, right? Because one of the things that you do with kids is you pick their friends. I mean, that's considered isn't that kind of one of the core responsibilities of parenthood, is narrowing their circle and deciding who's going to be in their world?
You can do that when they're little, but as they get bigger, you cannot do that anymore. Your time is running out, Michelle. I'm just telling you.
I hear, okay, well, thank you for that. But you see my question, Leslie? Look, how do you get that information? How do you get the benefit of other people's perspectives when you don't have an artificial creation like this?
It's a really fundamental question. And the only painful part of being on the show is that every time that I have talked about anything having to do with race, I have gotten so much hate email and phone calls from the black moms in my life. And they tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. And they're all right. It's true. But I'm trying. You can't see me because I'm on the radio, but I'm white. And I, as I always say, I'm very white.
Because we can tell.
Right. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Jill. And I just think that there's such a dearth of conversation between white moms and black moms in particular, even though we have such, or maybe because we have such a long, complicated history together in this country. And I don't know how you get that. I try to keep on being open and bumbling my way through it and just trying to look for the black moms in my life who seem willing to forgive me for the idiotic things I say. And maybe they're wiser than I am. And
Or maybe not.
Maybe not. Maybe they're just forgiving. I don't know. You know, and I just, It's astonishing to me how ignorant even I, and I think of myself as sensitive and well-educated, and I grew up in Washington, which is a majority black city, how little I know about the experience of being a person of color, a woman of color, a mom of color in this country. And I'm starving for it. I wish I had more of it. And it's my favorite thing about this show is that I've been able to be open and to be forgiven for the dumb things I say. And it's probably the saddest thing, the thing I'm going to miss the most about this show going off the air.
Jolene, what about you? How do you get that? I mean, you travel. I mean, you recently ran for lieutenant governor, and so you're in public life. Your husband is a former public official. So how do you get that without a? What do? You just ask? Walk up to people to Safeway?
You know, I think I have a very diverse life. I have friends from all walks of life. I don't have to have anything artificial to get this. You can just come over and have a drink sometimes, except for I don't think you really drink.
I don't, but she'll get me some Kool-Aid, I'm sure.
Exactly. Happy to, except for that's got artificial colors.
I knew that was coming. I knew that was coming.
But when we're picking our children's friends, when we have that opportunity when they're little, we need to do that more mindfully, perhaps, and make sure that you're not just picking black friends if you're black, and if you're white, only picking white friends for your kids. You have to make that step. And also, at the same time, those moms become your friends. So I think that if we can all just make a little extra effort, it's not just up to white people or up to black people or up to Latinos. It's up to all of us. You know, Asians have to make a little extra effort maybe, but we all just need to work a little harder to reach out.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end than that. So, Jolene Ivey, thank you. Jolene Ivey is the co-founder of the Mocha Moms, a parenting support group, a Maryland state lawmaker, a mom of five. Dani Tucker is a fitness instructor and an administrative assistant and a mom of two. She's with us on the line from her new office in Washington, D.C. Leslie Morgensteiner is an author and mom of three here in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Araceli Panameño, director of Latino Affairs at the Center for Responsible Lending, and a mom of one and a new grandma of one. Thank you all so much for joining us today and throughout the years, and your friendship and your wisdom. We thank you so much.
Gracias.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.